This reception, which was unlike anything I was used to, made me almost ill the whole evening, and the impression was intensified by what I saw in the prison. But I have already described my first hours in prison. I have already mentioned that the authorities did not and dared not show us any favour or make our tasks lighter than those of the other convicts. But on one occasion they did try to do so. For 3 whole months, B and T used to go to the engineer's office to do clerical work there. But this was done in strict secrecy, and was the engineering officer's doing. That is to say, all the other officials concerned knew about it, but they pretended not to. That happened when G was the commanding officer. Lieutenant Colonel G was a perfect godsend for the short time he was with us. Not more than 6 months, if I'm not mistaken. Perhaps even less. He made an extraordinary impression on the convicts before he left them to return to Russia. It was not simply that the convicts loved him. They adored him, if such a word may be used in relation to this. How he did it, I don't know, but he gained their hearts from the first moment. "He is a father to us, a father! We've no need of a father!" The convicts were continually saying, all the time he was at the head of the engineering department. I believe he was a terribly dissipated character. He was a little man with a bold, self-confident expression, but at the same time he was kind, almost tender with the convicts, and he really did love them like a father. Why he was so fond of the convicts I can't say, but he could not see a convict without saying something kindly and good-humoured to him, without making a joke or laughing with him, and the best of it was there was no trace of the authoritative manner in it, nothing suggestive of condescending or purely official kindness. He was their comrade, and completely one of themselves. But although he was instinctively democratic in manner and feeling, the convicts were never once guilty of disrespect or familiarity with him. On the contrary. But the convict's whole face lit up when he met the lieutenant colonel, and taking off his cap, he was all smiles when the latter came up to him. And if the officer spoke, the convict felt as though he had received a present. There are popular people like this. He looked a manly fellow. He walked with an erect and gallant carriage. "He is an eagle," the convicts used to say of him. He could, of course, do nothing to mitigate their lot. He was only at the head of the engineering work, which, having been settled and laid down by law once and for all, went on unchanged, whoever was in command. At most, if he chanced to come across a gang of convicts whose work was finished, he would let them go home before the drum sounded, instead of keeping them hanging about for nothing. But the convicts liked his confidence in them, the absence of petty fault-finding and irritability, the utter lack of anything insulting in speech or manner in his official relations with them. If he had lost 1,000 rubles and a convict had picked the money up, I do believe, even if it were the worst thief in prison, he would have given it back. Yes, I am sure of that. With intense sympathy, the convicts learnt that their eagle had a deadly quarrel with our hated major. It happened during the first month G was there. Our major had at some time served with him in the past. After years of separation, they met as friends and used to drink together. But their relations were suddenly cut short. They quarrelled, and G became his mortal enemy. There was a rumour that they had even fought occasionally, which was by no means out of the question with our major. He often did fight. When the convicts heard about this, their delight knew no bounds. "As though old Eight Eyes could get on with a man like that! He is an eagle, but the major a—" And here usually followed a word quite unfit for print. The prisoners were fearfully interested to know which had given the other a beating. If the rumours of the fight had turned out to be false, which was perhaps the case, I believe our convicts would have been very annoyed. "You may be sure the colonel got the best of it," they used to say. "He's a plucky one, though he is small, and the major crawled under the bed to get away from him, they say." But G soon left us, and the convicts sank into despondency again. Our engineering commanders were all good, however. 3 or 4 succeeded one another in my time. "But we shall never have another like him," the convicts used to say. "He was an eagle, and our champion." This G was very fond of us political prisoners, and towards the end he used to make B and me come to work in his office sometimes. After he went away, this was put on a more regular footing. Some in the engineering department, especially one of them, were very sympathetic towards us. We used to go there and copy papers. Our handwriting even began to improve, when suddenly there came a peremptory order from the higher authorities that we were to be sent back to our former tasks. Someone had already played the spy. It was a good thing, however. We had both begun to be fearfully sick of the office. Afterwards, for 2 years, B and I went almost inseparably to the same tasks, most frequently to the workshops. We used to chat together, talk of our hopes and convictions. He was a splendid fellow, but his ideas were sometimes very strange and exceptional. There is a certain class of people, very intelligent indeed, who sometimes have utterly paradoxical ideas. But they have suffered so much for them in their lives, they have paid such a heavy price for them, that it would be too painful, almost impossible, to give them up. B listened to every criticism with pain and answered with bitterness. I dare say he was more right than I was in many things. I don't know. But at last we parted, and I was very sad about it. We had shared so many things together. Meanwhile, M seemed to become more melancholy and gloomy every year. He was overwhelmed by depression. During my early days in prison, he used to be more communicative. His feelings found a fuller and more frequent utterance. He had been in prison for 2 years when I first came. At first, he took an interest in a great deal of what had happened in the world during those 2 years, of which he had no idea in prison. He questioned me, listened, was excited. But towards the end, as the years went on, he seemed to be more concentrated inside himself and shut up in his own mind. The glowing embers were being covered up by ash. His exasperation grew more and more marked. Je hais ces brigands. I hate these brigands, he often repeated to me, looking with hatred at the convicts, whom I had by then come to know better, and nothing I could say in their favour had any influence. He did not understand what I said, though he sometimes gave an absent-minded assent. But the next day he would say again, Je hais ces brigands. We often used to talk in French, by the way, and because of this, a soldier in the engineers called Dranishnikov nicknamed us the Medicals. I don't know for what reason. M showed warmth only when he spoke of his mother. She is old, she is ill, he said to me. She loves me more than anything in the world, and in here I don't know whether she is alive or dead. To know that I had to run the gauntlet was enough for her. M did not come from the privileged class, and before being sent to exile had received corporal punishment. He used to clench his teeth and look away when he recalled it. Towards the end, he used to walk alone more and more frequently. One morning, about midday, he was summoned by the governor. Our governor came out to him with a good-humoured smile.
"Well, M, what did you dream about last night?" he asked. "I trembled," M told us afterwards. "I felt as though I had been stabbed through the heart." "I dreamt I had a letter from my mother," he answered. "Better than that, better than that," replied the governor. "You are free. Your mother has petitioned in your favour, and her petition has been granted. Here is her letter, and here is the order relating to you. You will leave the prison at once." He came back to us, pale, unable to recover from the shock. We congratulated him. He pressed our hands with his cold and trembling ones. Many of the common convicts, too, congratulated him and were delighted at his good luck. He was released and remained in our town as a settler. Soon he was given a post. At first he often came to our prison, and when he could, told us all sorts of news. Politics was what interested him most. Besides M, T, B, and Z, there were two quite young men who had been sent for brief terms, boys of little education but honest, simple, and straightforward. A third, A. Chukovsky, was quite a simpleton, and there was nothing special about him. But a fourth, B.M., a middle-aged man, made a very disagreeable impression upon all of us. I don't know how he came to be one of the political prisoners, and indeed he denied all connection with them himself. He had the coarse soul of a petty huckster and the habits and principles of a shopkeeper who had grown rich by cheating over a halfpence. He was entirely without education and took no interest in anything but his trade. He was a painter, and a first-rate one, magnificent. Soon the authorities heard of his talent, and all the town began wanting B.M. to paint their walls and ceilings. Within 2 years he had painted almost all the officials' houses. Their owners paid him out of their own pockets, and so he was not at all badly off.
But the best of it was that his comrades, too, began to be sent to work with him. Two who went out with him continually learnt the trade, too, and one of them, Tijevsky, became as good a painter as he was himself. Our major, who lived in a government house himself, sent for B.M. in his turn and told him to paint all the walls and ceilings. Then B.M. did his utmost. Even the Governor-General's house was not so well painted. It was a tumble-down, very mangy-looking, one-story wooden house, but the interior was painted as though it were a palace, and the Major was highly delighted. He rubbed his hands and declared that now he really must get married. "With such a house, one must have a wife," he added quite seriously. He was more and more pleased with B.M., and through him with the others who worked with him. The work lasted a whole month. In the course of that month, the Major quite altered his views about the political prisoners and began to patronize them. It ended with his summoning Zed one day from the prison.
"Zed," he said, "I have wronged you. I gave you a flogging for nothing. I know it. I regret it. Do you understand that? I regret it."
Zed replied that he did understand it.
"Do you understand that I, your commanding officer, have sent for you to ask for your forgiveness? Do you feel that? What are you beside me? A worm. Less than a worm, you are a convict, and I, by the grace of God, am a major, a major. Do you understand that?"
Zed answered that he understood that, too.
"Well, now I am making peace with you. But do you feel it? Do you feel it fully in all its fullness? Are you capable of understanding it? Only think, I, the Major!"
And so on. Zed told me about the whole scene himself, so even this drunken, quarrelsome, and vicious man had some humane feeling. When one takes into consideration his ideas and lack of culture, such an action may almost be called magnanimous. But probably his drunken condition had a good deal to do with it. His dreams were not realized. He did not get married, though he had fully made up his mind to do so by the time the decoration of his house was finished. Instead of being married, he was arrested, and he was ordered to send in his resignation. At the trial, all his old sins were brought up against him. He had previously been a provost of the town. The blow fell on him unexpectedly. There was immense rejoicing in the prison at the news. It was a festive day, a day of triumph. They said that the Major howled like an old woman and dissolved into tears. But there was nothing to be done. He retired, sold his pair of greys, and then his whole property, and even sank into poverty. We came across him afterwards, a civilian wearing a shabby coat and a cap with a cockade in it. He looked viciously at the convicts, but all his prestige had gone with his uniform. In a uniform, he was terrible, a deity. In civil dress, he became absolutely a non-entity and looked like a lackey. It's wonderful what a uniform does for men like that.